wanted to start off our program by saying, so how do we, as Christians, navigate the seasons of change? It's my hope that conversations like this one will open us up further to fresh ideas of how to be the body of Christ in today's world. We live in communities with people committed to faiths and ideologies other than our own. And as Presbyterians, our Book of Order says God alone is Lord of the conscience, God is the source. And our polity takes history seriously, that we are to learn from it as we face issues of faith and when we're faced with conflict. Our polity advocates that problems are best worked out in community and in service. So the World Council of Churches emphasizes that since we all live together with neighbors of other faiths, it's our responsibility to foster dialogue in a spirit of reconciliation and hope granted to us as Christians by Jesus Christ. And since all types of human communities are in the process of constant change, change that no doubt are accelerated in present times by technology, economic forces, and mass media. In such change, it is in the dialogue that we can learn and that we can perhaps keep from the temptation to think of only our own community. The gospel isn't limited to a particular culture, but through the inspiration of God's Spirit can shed light in all cultures and upon all in conflict. So let us pray. Help us to speak truth in a spirit of love. Help us to strive for your kingdom, God. Help us to refuse to limit God to the dimensions of our human understanding. Help us to bring integrity to our dialogue as genuine pilgrims seeking fruitful discussions. Help us to have faith that sets us free to be open to the faith of others, to risk, to trust, and to hold our conviction and our openness in balance. Amen.
So it's my pleasure to introduce our two guest speakers today. They have requested the chairs be in this kind of a circle so that we will have a discussion and a dialogue rather than a lecture. So I hope everyone is prepared to participate and ask them some good questions or make some good comments. Many of you may know Dr. Dodd Sims. He is a practicer of internal medicine here in Alexandria. He might be your doctor. But he also has been working with the immigrant community in Northern Virginia for 20 years. And he has a master's in theology from Wesley. So I think that's where Amy ran into him and pressed him into service now through that connection. Sally Seelgun, I'm hoping I'm pronouncing that correctly. I probably mangled it terribly. He is a teaching fellow in religion and culture at the Catholic University of America in D.C., and he teaches courses on Islam and world religions. He has done many other interesting things. He's been an adjunct faculty at Georgetown previously. He was at the University of Alberta in Canada, where he earned a master's, but also worked with populations there, and has taken tour groups to Turkey to try and increase a dialogue of open religious conversation and things of that sort. I thought it was interesting to note that he was the first Muslim exchange student at the Virginia Theological Seminary. So I hope you will join me in welcoming them and listening to them with great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much. It's very nice to be invited. It's nice to be among a circle of inquisitive Presbyterians. It's been a long time. I was raised in the First Presbyterian Church in Silsby, Texas, a small town, maybe there's 20, 25 families out of a sea of Baptists who went to the Presbyterian Church. My lovely wife here was in the sea of Baptists. I thought it was always curious that with only 20, 25 families that we called it the First Presbyterian Church as if there were ever going to be a Second Presbyterian Church in Silsby, Texas. So the format of what we're going to do this morning is I'm going to give a really brief introduction, mostly focused on how I came to be engaged with Islam and with certain movement within Islam. And then really turn it over to Solly to give a brief presentation, maybe 15 minutes. And hopefully that's going to leave us at least 20, 25 minutes or so to answer questions or your comments. So the overarching theme of this series, as I understand, is change. And change obviously leads to fear. And I think most of us, particularly educated Presbyterians, understand that the way to deal with fear is, one of the ways to deal with fear is through education and knowledge. And I want to make the point that, there are different ways to obtain knowledge, particularly about Islam, but that actually engaging with Islam is a very important way to do that. So more than just hearing lectures or even reading books, but actually making friends, going to events, visiting mosques, having Muslim friends for halal turkey at Thanksgiving and these sorts of things. So that's sort of the format of what we're going to be doing. Let me tell you a little bit of how I got involved, not because my life has been particularly interesting, but I think it shows one way in which people who want to become engaged with Islam, even in this very community, can do that. I actually went to Turkey many years ago, 1974. I hitchhiked by accident there. I was trying to get from Paris to Munich, but ended up in Istanbul. It's a long story. Stayed for a few days and was overwhelmed by the hospitality of the place and said, if I ever get a chance, I want to kind of learn the language and learn more about them. And medical school and family got in the way, and I didn't do much with that. But as I started practicing medicine, even in D.C. 30 years ago, I started seeing black Muslims in my population of patients, and particularly around time of something called Ramadan, which I now we all know, but 30 years ago we probably didn't know. We were having trouble controlling diabetics' sugar because they were fasting all day and eating all night. So I said, no, this is curious. I need to know more about this. About 20 years ago, I left my practice downtown and came out here and had been working with the immigrant population largely, besides my private practice. And had several clear encounters with Islam. I had a patient when I was on duty in the middle of the night at Alexander Hospital 10 years ago, perhaps, who was from Afghanistan, suddenly died. We didn't know why. And the family immediately at 3 in the morning wanted his body to be released so they could return it to Pakistan to be buried near the Afghan border. The Pakistan embassy was involved in the middle of the night. I was sort of at a loss. The staff was saying, we don't know why the guy died. We need to keep him for an autopsy. I had this group of 40 Afghan people really insisting that he be returned to his homeland. So a big cultural dilemma. I said, we need to know more about this. And then I think like a lot of us, 9/11 came. And the response to that for me was, other than praying a little bit, this a lot actually, in those days after that, was to say, I need to know more about this. And so I started taking language courses. I ended up taking Turkish and learned some Turkish, a little Arabic, some Urdu, enough to make my patient smile. But at that point, I said, I need to do something in a more sort of profound way. So I ended up going to seminary. And in seminary, I took the usual courses, but I ended up taking a very interesting course here at the Virginia Theological Seminary taught by Zainab Salih's wife. Mm-hmm. At the end of this course, the group of us who were taking the course were invited to go to Friday prayers at a mosque in Manassas. And we did that. That's where I met Sally. And then Sally in turn said, you know, I'm taking a group to Turkey. A study group to really engage closely with Islam and some of the other, actually the other diverse faiths that are present in Istanbul, the Jewish community, the Christian community. So we ended up doing, my wife and I went on that trip, had a very rewarding trip, and went again, and I went again. And so it sort of developed into a sort of a passion of mine. One of the things that, and I'm going to just introduce, because I introduced Sally, will explain this, is that one of the important aspects of Islam that I've become particularly involved with is a movement called the Nur Movement, and I'll explain that a little bit. It's based on the ideas of an Islamic scholar named Said Nursi, who died in 1960. Said Nursi was always in trouble. He was always in trouble for being sort of what we would call a moderate Islamic scholar. The very secular government in Turkey at that time, the Atatürk government, had him under house arrest basically for 30 years. The more conservative religious establishment didn't agree that it was some of his ideas about very openness to reason, to science, collaboration with Christianity and these sorts of things. And to this day, in much of the Muslim world, but particularly in Turkey, there's a grassroots movement that gets their ideas from Said Nursi. All over Turkey, there are basically what we would call student dormitories, where young students come to that city to study. They stay in the dormitories. They get together at night, not only to do their homework, but to read the works of Nursi, basically in a Bible study sort of way. And this is a very good grassroots movement that Salih has been part of as well. Interestingly, Virginia Theological Seminary has had a long-standing relationship with this movement. The Dean Markham over there, has written several books. We actually have a handout to give out at the end of the talk that will list some of the resources. So the Virginia Theological Seminary has a very long-standing relationship with this. Zainab, Salih's wife, has been there. Salih himself has been there. They offer a number of courses about this. And what's interesting is it's that particular movement, because it's based on this very moderate, to Christians, certainly accessible sort of Islam, has been a very good way to get engaged to develop engagement between Christians and Muslims. So it's a very kind of unique model and one that's very accessible. So that's sort of my background and how I got involved. I really want to let Salih speak now and give you his view on all of this. But again, just to reiterate that the general idea is that change is going to cause fear. We deal with fear through knowledge. A really important way of getting knowledge to deal with our fear is to move beyond simple passive knowledge, even beyond what we've called in the past dialogue, as important as that has been, but really to engage, to develop deep seated relationships with our Muslim friends as we all start to discuss the issue. So we'll let Salih give his ideas, and then we really want to engage everybody else in some dialogue here.
Thank you, Don. Good morning, everyone.
Morning. Morning.
Thank you for having me. I am delighted to be here, and I hope we will have a fruitful discussion. I would like to start with a prayer from the Quran. As you know, the Quran shares most of the biblical figures as well. You know, most of the biblical prophets also shared by the Quran. The Quran shares their stories. And one of the prayers is when Moses was asked, you know, by God to go and extend the message to Pharaoh. So he basically, as you know, he has a very rebellious attitude. He makes a prayer, and it says, "Rabbi shrah li sadri wa yassir li amri wa hlul 'uqdatan min lisani yafqahu qawli." This is the Arabic version. It says, "Oh God, help, you know, make them to understand my message and lift my heart and take care of my speech impediment." I mean, according to the Quran, he had also a speech impediment. So and of course he is very nervous, because again he thinks that he has lots of weaknesses, including that he is not a good speaker. That's why he asks Aaron to be his helper, his assistant. So why I am telling this, I am nervous like Moses, although we don't have the Pharaoh in the room, but it's not easy to speak before a highly educated community. So I ask your forgiveness for any shortcomings. So change, you know, just I want to focus on change both in Muslim and Christian community. Starting with the Muslim community, I should say that the last three centuries, 18, 19, 20th century, for the Muslim communities are soul-searching centuries. And we still have the symptoms, kind of the identity. And one of the major reasons that this search continues, has been continuing from 18th century on, is because, that you see there is a glorious history. You know, Muslims, they have a glorious history, right? Within, within a very short time, with the emergence of Islam, Islam was spread, in three continents within a very short time, right? And still, scholars, they struggle actually to have a genuine explanation what are the dynamics that really help Islam to emerge, you know, within a very short time, even challenging Christianity, right? And starting with 18th century, there is a dramatic decline, there is stagnation, the Muslim world is starting to fall behind of Europe, when it comes to technology, when it comes to economy, basically the problem of progress. And one of the major questions within the Muslim community, what is going on? What is happening to us? Why we are falling behind, although we have a very glorious history? And actually, in this discussion around change, the discussion about religion is the most important one. What should be the role of religion for us to get rid of our problems? Shall we, the discussion, shall we do like Europeans, the separation of the church and the state? To what extent religion should have a role in reform, solving our problems? And you see, the interesting thing, this is still a very important discussion in many Muslim countries. You know, think of Egypt, think of Turkey, think of Iran, think of Saudi Arabia. You have both voices. Although in some, the dominant voice rotates. Think of Iran before the revolution, right? There's a Shah, implementing some reforms. Think of Turkey. There's Atatürk, and then now there is more. A very pro-Islam government. But the question is still there. The change, the discussion around what should be the role of religion is still there. All right. So this is one thing, the stagnation and decline around, and what should be the role of religion. The second important discussion that help us to understand today's Muslim community is colonialism. And remember, until 1950s, more than 90% of the Muslim world were under colonization. And of course, in most cases, it's a very dramatic situation. And it's also linked to the stagnation and decline, because the idea is that, they do better than us, that's why they are superior than us, so they can control us, referring to the West or Europe. As far as I remember, there are just four countries that were not colonized, and I think Turkey, Iran, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia. But also in these cases, you see, the way the reforms were done from top to down. Again, the change, the way we see the change. For example, think of the way we get along with religious pluralism in America. I mean, it is more or less something that comes from the ground. People, we have lots of, problems if you think of, American history when it comes to religious diversity, right? But, I mean, step by step, it comes, there's a change from ground, and it's an organic change. And I would argue that the same thing with Europe as well, when it comes to, yes, there is a very sad situation when it comes to religious conflicts in Europe, right? Think of 16th century, think of 17th century. But again, because the change came from the ground, it was an organic change. But when it comes to reform with regard to religion in the Muslim countries, you don't see the same dynamic. In most cases, people, they were enforced to follow a certain lifestyle or the degree of that they can be religious. And because of the fact that it was not an organic change, and again, I think the best example is Turkey and Iran. I think in both cases, either this be, when it comes to bringing more religion into the public sphere, or removing religion from the public sphere, both cases, because it was a reactionary, it didn't work. I mean, I will say Turkey today is more religious than ever. And Iran, if you think of, the before revolution, it's a different Iran. Today is a completely different Iran. And I would say Iran will not stay like this either, because when you enforce people to be religious, then the other side will react. So these are kind of the challenges that we need to be aware of. And many problems that we have in the Muslim world actually are related to this, you know, kind of the idea of change, enforcement, that the fact that change was not organic. The other thing is that, I mean, although, you know, explaining to today's modern Islamic movements, it's a very complex issue. I would say an important aspect of these movements, like the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, the Wahhabi ideology or movement in Saudi Arabia, ISIS, Al-Qaeda, to some extent also has links to these issues. You know, that because you don't have an organic change in with regard to religion, then of course this will lead to extremism. And in Turkey, for example, extremism in both cases, you know, there are aggressive. The secularism in Turkey even actually more what's the best word? I mean, usually we use the word aggressive secularism even more strict than actually secularism in France. As you know, France is very famous with their secularism, right? But in America, it's more passive secularism, right? I mean, there's more role for religion. Although Turkey was 90% Muslim, that's why they have, I mean, something that bothers them about secularism. It's not that they, but again, because the experience was very painful. All right? So the movements are actually, in order to understand the, let's say, including the radical Muslim movements, we need to understand the context. And I think ISIS is part of this, which is very much close to Saudi ideology, you know, Wahhabi ideology. Al-Qaeda is more or less, again, just to understand, you know, Al-Qaeda is, you know, or Taliban, they are more dominant in Afghanistan. Think of time of Shah. Again, they also, because the reactionary movements produces reactionary, I mean, in both cases, either radical secularists or radical Islamists. So they both bring different problems. So what are the changes? So this is the context of the Muslim world. What are the changes today? And I would say one of the thing that I see personally is that it is so difficult to talk of dichotomies anymore. So what do I mean? I mean, it is difficult to say the West, the East. It is difficult to say the Christian world, the Muslim world. It is difficult to say Muslim civilization, Christian civilization, because of globalization. Examples. I mean, today there are 15 million Muslims who live in Europe, right? According to Pew Research Survey, 15 million. And the other thing, so if you think of America, yes, I mean, although still we have, you know, movements, or maybe in the climate, in the political climate, you see environment, you see those who say, well, this is a Christian country, but also this is the religiously one of the most diverse country on continent on earth. So it's just, I mean, although you can say, well, it's a majority Christian, but diversity is a reality. Yeah, I mean, I would say America is like a little Mecca. You know, if you during the pilgrimage, you will see people all around the globe, and the same thing with America. You know, and of course they bring their religion and culture as well. And I think the other interesting things when it comes to change, and although when it comes to immigrants or the relationship with Muslims, Europe has more problem than America. Still, a major city of Europe, London, they just elected a Muslim mayor, right? I mean, in London, and it was this year. And in Canada, actually, a major city in North America, in Calgary, they elected a Muslim mayor in 2010. And actually, in 2013, they re-elected him with 74% of votes. There's a Muslim mayor. So what does this tell us? This such a change is a reality. We cannot talk about the dichotomy of the West and the East, with the implication of religion. I think it has gone and it will continue. And the other thing is, it's interesting, like recently I was at the Fairfax Innova Hospital, and I was walking on the hall of the hospital, and they on the wall you see the kind of the, you know, the people on the administration, you know, the doctors, the staff. And I was amazed to see like the number of Muslims on the list, you know, with their pictures. And this is another thing. So I mean, just think of you know, in the context, Muslim doctors. Maybe Dad can talk about this more. It's a reality of this country, you know. I mean, we just not getting along with them is might be a troubling thing for all of us. So this is a change about, you know, the diversity, that dichotomies may not work anymore. The last thing is I want to talk about our common challenges. You know, it doesn't matter whether you are Christian or Muslim. There are some common challenges that we all need to get along, or we have to work together. So one is that I see is, although religion, let's say there's still more than half of our global population, they are still part of religion. You know, if you, you know, combine Muslims and Christians, it makes more than half of the world's population. But still, we see that religion is losing ground, right? Think of Europe, even in America, the number of nuns are increasing. So spiritually is also, I mean, spirituality is also, I would say, losing. I mean, at least it goes into a different direction. It takes different shapes, spirituality. You know, you may not be part of an organized religion. And this is especially the case with millennials. You know, I mean, I'm at the campus setup. As you know, the relationship of millennials with religion is very different. And I'm sure you'll see also in your families, in your children, there is a different dynamic. And this is also the case with Muslims. Maybe, I mean, perhaps in Europe or in America, it is faster, but this is also a reality in the Muslim world. I know many, many parents in Turkey, in different parts of the Muslim world, that they have struggled how to expose their children to spirituality, because they believe that spirituality is an important thing for their life. And it is a challenge. It's a Muslim challenge, it's a Christian challenge. This is, I mean, there are different dynamics about this. You know, one of it might be, you know, excessive materialism, or just there are so many different things. Your iPhone might be the most important thing for you. You know, that might be a major distraction for your spirituality. Just iPhone or just social media.
I hate the iPhone. Make it.
I hate it, but still I cannot separate myself from it. It's just love and hate relationship. The other thing is, again, we see biases actually on both sides. I mean, unfortunately, this is a sad situation to see the situation of Christian communities in the Middle East. And of course, the political climate in Europe, in America. And unfortunately, every day, I mean, me and my wife, we are now really seriously, we are concerned. Although we live in Alexandria, in a very diverse place. I mean, now I feel, I mean, this is the first time actually I feel that, you know, when you walk on the street, you feel as a stranger. This has never, I never had this experience before. I mean, I lived in Egypt. In Egypt, you feel, I mean, as a Muslim, you know, when you walk on the street, people with their stares, they make sure that you are a stranger. You don't belong here. But unfortunately, now Muslims, this is the situation of Muslims in this country. It is increasing. I should also say, you know, the overwhelming majority of you know, American community has been very supportive in terms of, you know, it's challenged a very divisive and fearful political rhetoric. But on the other hand, the other part is also a reality. We see actually more problems that we used to, because, you know, it feeds fear and divisions. And again, as I mentioned, this doesn't mean to dismiss the situation of, you know, religious communities in the Middle East. Unfortunately, their problem is, you know, It's way more difficult than Muslims here. And the other thing is, I would say when it comes to, you know, Christian-Muslim relations, one of the most important is really cooperation. You know, now the gap between the rich and the poor is widening, you know, including in America. And I think, you know, the mosques and church communities, they can work together in order to deal with the issues. Poverty is another problem, violence another problem, environmental issues. So there certainly, without the cooperation between Muslims and Christians, I don't think it is easy to be hopeful. And religion may help us, you know, cooperative religion may help us to deal with these issues. I mean, finally, I want to give an example, and I will finish here. Few years ago, actually, there was the list of maps in the Washington Post. Let's say the 20 most important maps that will help you to understand the world. And one of them was actually about Nutella. You know Nutella? My wife actually, she's from Germany, so if we don't buy like at least once a month Nutella, she will rebel. You know, she will say, okay, I will not do anything. And actually what was interesting about Nutella, so they put the map of Nutella, you can check actually online. Where do they bring their products in order to make Nutella? So hazelnut comes from Turkey, and palm oil comes from Malaysia, cacao comes from Nigeria, and sugar comes from Brazil, and vanillin comes from France. So it comes from different countries. And then they also showed on the map, they showed the factories. And actually it's spread all over the world. And all the other point that they make, the way that they distribute. And actually, it spans all over the globe. So the idea, this is a beautiful thing, right? I mean, no one is against it. Well, why do we bring like this from Nigeria? Because why it comes from Turkey? You know, we don't have any problem, right? Hazelnut is fine. But when it comes to maybe, why don't we bring many immigrants from Nigeria? This is different from cacao, right? So the idea is that when it's so, I mean, from Nutella, I want to go to one of the, you know, the statement of Martin Luther King that injustice anywhere, injustice everywhere. So basically, yes, this is the global reality. Evil anywhere is evil everywhere. I mean, we may say, well, when it comes to, you know, physical security, that, you know, we don't have many problems with, let's say, people who are displaced in Syria. But, you know, if we did not lose our consciousness, the least we feel something in our heart when we see, you know, people are drowned in the sea, you know, just basically to escape violence. So the idea is that if we really don't do it, I mean, it will come to us today or tomorrow. Thank you.
So we'd like to open it up to a conversation with all of you, if anybody has questions.
And then we are open to any question.
Yep, questions, thoughts, and I'll pass the microphone.
This session is very encouraging. My hope would be going on in mosques and churches all over our country. But here's my question. Unfortunately, and because it sells newspapers, most of the publicity we get on Islam is, of course, the radical, the terrorist issues. And what I am interested in from, say, the Muslim community, and it has to go for the Christian, is how, where are the voices and how might we make them louder and clearer about the civility of Islam and Christianity, about the goals we share, and some of the very distinctive elements in both faiths that are very positive for mankind. So I'm really looking, I'm hungry to see a wave of response. And if you could discuss that a little bit, I think it would help all of us enlarge our hope.
Dr. Yes. Ask this question.
Yeah, I mean, I think as I mentioned, I think that it's great to have conversations among people who are sort of open-minded. I think the challenge is to probably start having conversations with people who are less open-minded. And then, in fact, even to move beyond conversation, actually to do things. And that's why I mentioned this word that we keep talking about, and among those of us do this thing, is sort of this engagement. And again, there's a list of resources we're going to hand out at the end, but I think it starts as a grassroots movement. As Solly said, top-down things just don't work in the long run. It's going to start as a grassroots, bottom-up thing. And I think it's literally, it's mosque visits, it's interfaith book groups, it's joining together in service projects, and then spreading the word, and not only in your own group where people may share most of your opinions, but in your workplace where people don't share your opinions, or among your neighbors, and that sort of thing. So I think it's got to be grassroots. It's got to go beyond just discussion, informing yourself about the issues, reading the paper. I think it's really got to be much more engaging and active.
Can we get the newspapers and the television to start picking up those stories? I mean, that's where the mass media is.
Yeah, the answer is I don't know the answer to that. I mean, there's certainly are ways of getting alternative information that I think is more objective about the situation. A number of independent news outlets and this sort of thing that are much better than sort of the Fox News, CNN kind of breathless take on breaking stories.
Can I add something?
And one of the most valuable things that I did with George Pair and some people in this room is we had a dialogue group with the Baptist Church down here, Alfred Street, for several years. And every Sunday, I believe it was, in the evening, several of us from both congregations got together and talked. And then as the trust level expanded, our talk got deeper and deeper, and we challenged ourselves. And of course, there are places where we could start a dialogue group with another, so that's something that Patrick Honeycutt at the head of missions or Adult Ed or any number of places that we could challenge ourselves by something like that.
I mean, sometimes when it comes to change, in many cases we have the tendency, if we change the media, then everything would, will be all right. I don't think this is the case. I mean, this is just an illusion, and it would not work. So it should come from the ground. There is a saying in Turkish that says if everyone cleans in front of his or her house, the street would be clean. So the idea is that little things, instead of expanding our wings. Just little things will be really just, if in your workplace, try to engage with your Muslim friend, or in your neighborhood, in the hospital. And sometimes, it is difficult to engage with someone who looks like different from you, it has scarf, sometimes they have a long beard, it might be intimidating, oh my goodness, how can I engage with this guy or this lady, full covered, but this is what we need. And in most cases, you will see really beautiful smiles behind of these long beards, covers. Just do your part. I mean, little things will really make lots of difference. And the other thing is, we shouldn't forget that, we are constantly filtered with bad news, with negative news. This is the job of the media. This is how they make people read. That's why I think in the context of media, they say if a dog bites a person, it's not news. But if a person bites a dog, that this is the news. It has to be scandalous. Otherwise, people will not open their eyes. Right. This is the other thing.
Can you tell us more about the Muslim population in Alexandria and Northern Virginia?
Mm-hmm. Good. So I. Okay.
Vanna White.
Vanna White, yeah. Strong
resemblance. Doc, do you want to answer this question?
Because I see a lot of people from a lot of countries. The best research data that I found is that actually Virginia is second among the 50 states, second closest to the top in terms of Muslim population's percentage of the greater population, second only to Illinois. It's in the 2.67% range. But what's important to recognize, almost all of that is concentrated in Northern Virginia.
Yeah.
So Fairfax County, even Loudoun County, some of these places have just by far huge concentrations. Foreign-born in general, 30% or more, which is very high for the United States, but a large part of it is Muslim. In the clinic, we see people from, the 168 proverbial countries. The large majority of Muslims here actually turn out to be from Ethiopia. We all think of Ethiopians as being Christians, and they are 50%, but the other 50% are Muslims. And so a huge percentage of Ethiopians here are Muslim, as are the related places, Eritrea, for instance, where there are a lot of Eritrean immigrants. A lot of Egyptians here, a lot of Moroccans here. And then the Afghans, I think, that came in a huge wave. So people from all over, but sometimes not recognized. I think that's true, certainly of the some of the Ethiopian population, and actually even some of the people from West Africa. So a number of the people from Sierra Leone would be Muslim.
So when it comes to the dynamic of the Muslim community, but in general, so that answered your question. I hope in Virginia and then, Alexandria. The majority of Muslims in this country, they are African Americans, those who came mainly as slaves. So, I mean, they have been here for a long, long time.
I would like to thank our speakers today for their insights and perspectives. Thank you very much for that, and I think that was very, very much needed. All discussions of this nature are eye-openers for all the people. I would like to add just a few comments myself on the subject. In my education courses, graduate courses in education, where I train teachers, I say to my students, American students as well as international students, that in their classes in the United States, they are going to have quite a number of minority groups in their classes, coming from different nationalities, different cultural backgrounds, different religions. And I say, if you don't know much about Islam, you should know something about it, because in your classes you are going to have Muslim students. And when I have a Muslim student, I say, I'm not imposing, but I would like to suggest that one of your oral reports should be on Islam, and I give them three subjects. The five pillars of Islam, education in Islam, and the place of women in Islam. And then I say to the students, it's nice for you to know the background of all of your students, but especially the Muslim students, because very little is known about Islam in general in this part of the world. Mm-hmm. And it's good not to be driven by what is in the media and the bad stories that are happening, because out of those, sometimes we make generalizations about people and religions and things like that. I just want to give one additional comment for all of us to think about. In Lebanon, during our 15-year civil war, we had conflicts of different kinds. There were political conflicts, for sure. National conflicts, yes. But within the country itself, the biggest single conflict was between Christians and Muslims. And there were lots of organizations that wanted to bring about more dialogue, more understanding, and so on. And for the youth, there was a very nice attempt to bring Christian youth and Muslim youth together in a big conference. This, they realized, they could not handle in Lebanon, because if it was in a Christian community, the Muslims would be afraid to go. If it was in a Muslim community, the Christians would be afraid to go. So they had that conference in Cyprus. Mm-hmm. Okay, so Christian and Muslim youngsters, high school students, college students, and so on, went to that conference. And one of the Christians coming from a Christian community in Lebanon, after being introduced to the other people in the conference, said to the director, I'm sorry, I cannot sleep in the dormitory, because in the dormitory there are Muslim students and I have never met a Muslim in my life. He was in a Christian community, 100% Christian community in Lebanon, and he said, I have never seen any Muslim. They said, well, we have no other place to put you. He said, well, I will sleep anywhere. They had a cot for him for two nights in the corridor. But in the meetings, he met with all of those people. After 2 days, he went to the doctor and he said, the Muslims I have met here are pretty good people, and I don't mind now sleeping in the dormitory. And as a matter of fact, he made some excellent friends with the Muslim boys and girls in the conference. As we grew up in Palestine and in Lebanon, we learned to deal with Jewish people, Muslim people, and Christian people. And some of our best friends at home before the creation of Israel in Palestine. Some of our best friends and colleagues in business and in schools and so on were Christian, Muslim, and Jewish. And I think when people live with other people, they get to know them in their homes, get to know something about their culture, get to know something about their customs, get to know something about their even prejudices and biases, because these are eye-openers as well. People who live with each other and experience other people develop a personal feeling of communion, oneness, cooperation, understanding, acceptance, tolerance, etc. So if we have opportunities to listen to more of these discussions, it would be wonderful. But at the same time, I would like to encourage everybody here, families and persons, to get to know people from other faiths and other religions and other nationalities and other cultures, because these are not only eye-openers, they are very enriching in our own lives.
Right, sure.
And different political persuasions.
Thank you for being here. I have a basic question about the Islam religion. It's all very nice that we want to try to get together. I think that there is a perception that the religion of Islam is very intolerant of differences, even within its own, within Islam itself, and of others who might have different beliefs. Intolerant, even to the degree of violence and coercion. I wonder if you could address that.
Thank you. I think, I mean, the perception is reality. This is, but I think it's not a fair perception, and for the following reasons. So one thing is actually Quran engages with diversity. You know, if you see the Quran, we engage with, you know, Jews, Judaism, the Quran itself, Christianity, Zoroastrianism, the Quran, and also historically, if you think of Islam in the history, you know, starting from, you know, let's say today's Mecca, Medina. For example, for the 300 years, once, you know, Muslims, they conquered, you know, Jerusalem, Egypt, they were minorities actually. You know, they were governing, but they were minority for 300 years. You know, they, you know, Christians, Jews. This is one thing. The other thing, if you think of history, Muslim history, for example, Muslims, they ruled India for centuries, right? Although today we barely associate India with Islam, for example, certainly the, based on the Quran, Muslim scholars, they made a room to get along with, you know, with Hindus, with, I mean, certainly there are conflicts, but it was actually based on the Quranic theology, although both in the Christian tradition, in Judaism, and in Islam, historically, you know, theological position was that, you know, Hindus, they were, you know, worshipping idols, you know, it's like a polytheist tradition. You know, now with, you know, with modernity, that person, you know, there is a different theology it's offered. But this is the one thing. If you think of, for example, the context of Ottoman Empire, there was actually a millet system. There is a special term that is used for Christians and Jews, the people of the book, which is also based on the Quran. And actually, the meaning of this word is those who are protected. Because in the context of 16th century, you know, it is extremely difficult to talk about religious diversity. Think of Europe, right? Think of, let's say, the glorious, you know, Muslims, they also, you know, ruled in, you know, in Spain. And if you were the Jews in Spain, they went after the Inquisition. They went to the Muslim territories. And in Russia, when religiously it became very intolerant, they went to the Muslim territory. And still we have actually the Jewish community linked to the Jewish community, those who came after the Inquisition, the majority. So one last thing, for example, today, I think the perception, especially in today's world, mainly related to when, you know, ISIS, you know, took the territories, you know, displaced and killed, you know, hostage and many Yazidis and Christians, right? This, including also Zoroastrians. I mean, just one question that, I mean, let's say, think of before ISIS. I mean, before ISIS, that means in Islam there was a room to accommodate Yazidis, to accommodate Zoroastrians, to accommodate Christians, and also before the establishment of Israel, to accommodate Jews. You know, I mean, unfortunately, the number of Jews in the Muslim majority countries diminished significantly after the establishment. But before, you see that, I can argue that, well, based on the history, I can argue that, well, it seems it was tolerant. But what happened all of a sudden with modernity that Muslims became so intolerant? So my point is that I think just reducing it to Islam will not be a fair point, because historically you have thousands of examples. But with modernity, I think modernity brought different dynamics and challenges, and Muslims are no exception. I hope this helps.
I also wanted to thank you for coming today, because I think this is a real important discussion for us to have. I'm a returned Peace Corps volunteer from Morocco and Senegal, so I spent 3 years living in Muslim countries and came away from that feeling like we're more alike than we are different. But I also feel like all of us can do things, and I appreciate you sharing your experience living in Alexandria, because we're one of the most ethnically diverse areas mm-hmm. of the United States and one of the most tolerant. So for you to walk down the street and feel a little uncomfortable nowadays, I think is really a wake-up call for all of us. So I personally have reached out to all of my Muslim friends because of the rhetoric we hear now and just tried to support them. And we just had Eid al-Kabir this week, which is what we call it in Morocco. It's the festival of slaughtering the sheep, which is from Abraham, the story in the Bible. Mm-hmm. So something we can all relate to. So I've used that as an opportunity. But I wanted to ask you if you see any connection, like I'm fearful of a connection of having rhetoric that's anti-Muslim nowadays, and if that helps recruit more terrorists. And so I feel like all of us helping to make people feel welcome here, does that help us reduce the risk of people becoming radicalized because they feel ostracized from the society and like they have no place here? So if you could speak to that, please.
Shall I answer this?
I put the handout material by both doors, so when you leave, feel free to take one.
Mm-hmm. I think one of the major issue that we have in a way when it comes to our relation with the Muslim community is about uniformity. And this is not an American thing, this is not a European thing. I think this is part of the history that we have the tendency to, you know, to have people to think like us, to look like us, to dress like us. And I will say, this is also an important, one of a way of to explain the history. You know, if you think the conflicts is, you know, I will say it's all about uniformity. You know, we have, as human beings, we have the tendency, to uniform the globe, I think. And I think this is partly related to, so when you see a Muslim looks like different, you know, dressed differently, I don't know, have a beard, a different kind of, I mean, I accept that it is an intimidating thing, but also it's a reality. I think Muslims, they make 1/4 of the world, you know, I mean, one in four people in the world is a Muslim, right? So, I mean, uniformity is not a good option, although there is a tendency that we have hope, you know, with the idea of integration. I mean, it doesn't work. But I do believe that you know, not making people home will eventually lead to radicalization. And I think the good example we see, unfortunately, sadly, many Muslims are radicalized in Europe. I mean, this is, I don't want to scapegoat the external dynamics also the Muslim community to say, well, this is why the Muslim community, they become radicalized. Of course, I think when it comes to criticism, Muslims, they should criticize themselves. You know, I mean, at the end, this is a Muslim who's going to exploit himself or herself. So, as a Muslim community, I mean, I think that this, the idea of criticizing the outside dynamics should never be a departure point. First, it starts for myself. When a Muslim is radicalized, I criticize myself. Do I do enough as a Muslim to prevent a Muslim to get radicalized? But I think it is not fair for someone from outside of the Muslim community also to criticizing a Muslim for being radicalized as a departure point. I think a Christian should also, should start from himself or herself. Do I do enough? Do we consider a radicalized Muslim as our own issue? Is this like something is happening in my family, in my home? And I mean, I agree with you that it will eventually lead to radicalization.
Well, I want to honor our time together, and it's time to close, but I want to thank you both. I have something for both of you before you go. And Sally's wife will be with us in February. We will have another opportunity to have another program. So,
by the way, she's a smarter person than me. So,
thank you all for being here, and thank you very much for this.
Thank you.